Chapter 5. Many Meetings. That night there was a meeting which all the headmen went to. In this, Dame Boris advised that the invaders should be attacked immediately, but it was Doramin who decided against this. He pointed out that the men could stay on their hill and die of hunger, or they would try to get to their boat and be shot by the men from the forest. These strangers were defenseless and could be killed without the risk of a battle. Dane Waris was ordered by Doramin to go 10 miles down the river and camp there in case the white men tried to escape. In my opinion, this was done to protect his son, because his bravery would put him in great danger if he was near the attackers. The Raja's representative at these talks was a man called Kasim. He told the group that he himself would try to make contact with the white men, but he had a little plan of his own. He went and found Cornelius and gave him the job of interpreter. The next day, Brown heard a voice from the top of his hill, in English, ask for permission to speak to the men. Brown was very happy about this, as he no longer felt hunted like a wild animal. Half an hour's talk with Cornelius opened Brown's eyes to the events and politics of Patusan. But before he would talk about any plans for peace, he told Cornelius that he wanted food to be sent to him as a sign of good faith. Later, Cornelius returned to the hill with Kasim. Kasim hated Doramin and the Bugis, but he hated Jim even more and saw this as a way to end the white man's power forever. He told Brown that he and his men should fight for the Raja, and if they did so, they would be given their freedom. Brown agreed with this diplomacy, but only to give himself time, as to him it seemed the best person to do business with would be the white man. They could work together to take control of the island, and then one day, after some argument, Brown would kill Jim and become king. Later that day, Brown saw a man on the other side of the river, about 200 meters away. Brown decided that he would teach these people a lesson, and called for one of his men, a Yankee, who was an excellent shot. The man dropped to one knee, aimed, and fired. He immediately stood up to look. The man fell to the ground and didn't move. Brown told me later that this had put the fear of instant death into these people. That night, all was quiet on top of Brown's hill, but from the village came a loud tremor, like hundreds of feet stamping and noise of many voices. It was then Brown confessed that he thought he had finally met his end. It seemed there would be no chance for escape. Then one of the whites remembered he had left some tobacco in the boat and told the men he would go and get it. Brown let him, thinking there was no danger. A moment later, the man was climbing into the boat and then out again. "I've got it," he cried. Then, with no warning, there was a sudden flash from close to the boat. "I am hit," cried the man. Instantly, all the men started firing in the direction of the shot. After much panic and noise, Brown managed to stop the firing. Then a strong voice was heard close to the hill, speaking in the native language. This was followed by the English, translated by Cornelius. "Do you hear on the hill?" "Speak," shouted Brown. The voice continued, "Between the men of the Bugis and the white men on the hill, there will be no faith, no speech, no compassion, no peace." The wounded man continued to moan during the night. Sometimes the cries were loud, sometimes almost whispers. He was a strong man and died hard. Never for a moment did the noises from him stop. Brown and his men had to listen to their comrade for a full 6 hours, until finally the tide came in and the river silenced him. Soon after this, there was a great shout from the village and a big drum began to beat. "He has come," said Cornelius. "What is all that noise for?" asked Brown. "For joy," replied Cornelius. "He is a very great man. He will come and talk to you, but he is a fool. He is not afraid of anything. And then, Captain, you tell that man of yours with the rifle to shoot him. Kill him, and all the others will do anything you want them to do." Brown looked at his men. They were cold, tired, and scared. But he still wished for one more chance, for some other grave. That day, Jim and Brown met each other. Brown hated Jim at first sight. Whatever hopes he had of working with Jim disappeared immediately. He hated the other man's youth and confidence. They met across the river, and for some time they stood looking at each other.
"Who are you?"
asked Jim at last.
"My name's Brown. What's yours?"
Jim paused and then continued his questions.
"What made you come here?"
"That's easy," Brown replied bitterly. "Hunger."
"And what made you?"
Brown told me later that Jim had gone very red in the face, as he did not like in any way being asked questions. He was too big and powerful for that.
"We don't ask for anything but to be given a clear fight or a clear road back from where we came. Why don't you tell me about your life?" he asked.
"No? Well, I'm sure I don't want to hear it anyway. I know it's no better than mine. You talk as if you were one of those people that should have wings, so as to go about without touching the dirty earth." Brown told me he had asked Jim many questions about his life and tried to persuade him that they were the same. At last he threw himself on the ground and watched Jim out of the corners of his eyes. Jim stood on the side of the river thinking. Finally he spoke.
"Will you promise to leave this place and give me your weapons?"
"You think I'm crazy?" Brown replied. "I am to get to Madagascar with no money, just the ship I have and the clothes on my back?"
"Oh no, we are going to keep our guns."
"Very well," said Jim. "You will either have a clear road or a clear fight." Jim walked away and they never saw each other again. On his way back to the hill, Brown met Cornelius.
"Why didn't you kill him?" he asked unhappily.
"Because I can do better than that," Brown said with amusement.